Welcome, everyone. End of the day session. I admire your dedication for hanging in there. So this one will not hurt your heads too much. This is mostly a conceptual talk, talking about design guidance. So the idea here is to get you thinking about how these new modern UI design guidelines fit when you start thinking about line of business applications. Because there's a sort of a inherent disconnect between the traditional line of business app and the way we think about what that looks like on screen compared to all these samples and demos and things you see with Windows Store apps that are very sparse and very content consumption oriented, but not necessarily matching the kinds of apps line of business app developers are building. Let me see a quick show of hands here. Always like to interrogate my audiences to get you comfortable. How many of you are already building in some form? You know, if you've just done a Hello World, don't raise your hand. But if you're already building a Windows Store application for a business scenario, okay, pretty good number. Okay, all right. So, quick, who am I? I'm Brian Noyes. I am with a company called Soliance. We do end-to-end development projects, consulting, architecture consulting, training, that kind of thing. I'm also a Microsoft Regional Director for the Mid-Atlantic region. That's Washington, D.C. and the surrounding states. There's about 130 of us worldwide. If you haven't heard of that program, kind of picked by Microsoft, somewhat similar to the MVP program in that we work with the product teams, help evangelize their product. But we also do a little bit more direct feedback to senior leadership at Microsoft as well. Also an MVP, Pluralsight author. I've got a couple of courses on building Windows Store apps out there. If you aren't a Pluralsight subscriber, make sure you stop by the Pluralsight booth and get a card. In fact, I have some cards I can give out at the end as well. They've got 1 month free passes, and there's over 500 courses in the library there. So lots of training to be had there, and you got a 1 month window to try it out and see if you like it. On various insider groups, that's not very important here. Probably important is my contact info. Do feel free to contact me offline. We've got a decent-sized group here today. If you do want to ask a question, try to get my attention. I'll try to repeat back the question so everyone can hear it. And I'll certainly take questions at the end, especially since there's no session after this. Also, immediately after this, down in the Hall 10 there, they're going to have the Ask the Experts session. So I'm going to be going down there. If you want to have a nice long conversation about your scenarios or what you're trying to do, feel free to join me down there, and they will have frosty beverages down there as well. All right, keep losing my remote here. So objectives today, like I said, this is not a deep technical. In fact, I have no plans to show code unless there are specific questions about how do you do something. It's more to think about the overall design patterns, and specifically there's this overarching set of design guidelines for modern applications that you may or may not have had any direct or deep exposure to. Let me see a quick show of hands. How many people here have attended some other session that was just focused on the modern UI style guidelines? Okay, only a couple. Good. So part of this session is going to be kind of stepping through some of those specific guidelines, but doing it within the context of line of business apps, which does kind of shift your focus on how you might implement some of those things. So we'll talk about some of the built-in controls and how to go about using those. Towards the end, I'll talk about data, because obviously data is very important to line of business apps. And I'll also talk about it a little bit in a light that you don't see much in other Windows Store samples, is more data entry type scenarios and what are some of your options there, but also certainly data consumption in various different forms. So basically just try to get your brain thinking about this a little more and how you might start joining into this world of Windows Store applications for line of business type scenarios. So one thing that normal line of business applications have in common is lots of fill in the blank. And here we mention actions, buttons, menus, toolbars, lots of clutter, really. And you know, if you've seen anything about the modern UI guidelines so far, it's all about content over Chrome. So buttons, toolbars, menus, status bars, all those things are not supposed to be there in the first place. So that's one thing you have to start melding your mind to, is figuring out, okay, obviously these things still need to happen in my app. You still have the same set of requirements if you're moving an app into this arena and you have to get things done, but you have to figure out how to, you know, move those actions and things into a form that complies with the modern UI style guidelines. Now, one other thing I should say up front here is keep in mind that a Windows Store application, when it's running, is nothing more than a full screen canvas. So certainly you can do whatever the heck you want in terms of presenting your data, your functionality, your buttons. You know, if you want to have one big screen with 500 buttons on it, all this big, you know, pixel width that you have to click very precisely with a mouse, you know, the Microsoft Black Helicopters aren't going to come out and haul you away for doing that. But if you're going to try to put it into the Windows Store, you may have some problems there. So there are certain things within the modern UI guidelines that acceptance into the Windows Store you could be blocked for, but most of it is guidelines. These are, you know, things to enforce consistency, to try to get you to build your apps in ways that your users can find what they expect in places they expect it. You know, a good example of this is how many of you have built an application with a menu in it that had file in that menu? I was going to say, okay, you guys are just getting tired at the end of the day. I know there's more than that. So, you know, how many of you put that file menu somewhere other than at the far left of that menu? Hopefully no hands go up for that. So, you know, there are previous design guidelines that we've all been complying with, either implicitly or explicitly, if you've ever gone and looked at some of the previous design guidelines from Microsoft. And these are just the modern form of that. The fact that your applications tend to run full screen gives you more real estate to deal with. So you would start to think, well, I've got more real estate. There's even more room for putting all this Chrome and stuff. But it's more of a design paradigm that they're trying to enforce. The clutter is bad. Distractions are bad for a user. Keep them focused on the stuff they're currently working with and only show them that other stuff when they really need to interact with it. So traditional line of business applications are the direct opposite of that at a starting point. The design once run everywhere, what that's kind of talking about is the fact that all too often in line of business apps, at least in my experience working and consulting with lots of companies, not a lot of design actually goes into the user experience of that application. It's more focused around, you know, here's the bullet points of functionality we need. Here's the data we need to shove on the screen somewhere. Developers go figure it out, make it happen. And there's not a lot of thought into particular use cases that the end user is going to have within that app and different personas and the way those different personas use your application. So that's something, you know, as you move into this world, designers become a much more important part of this, or at least developers with some sort of design sense. You can still certainly build, you know, terribly ugly applications in Windows Store applications, particularly for line of business, if you're going to sideload them and not even go into the Windows Store. But you know, you want to try to do better now that you're getting a fresh start in a new technology. So you know, your typical line of business app, this is a very old one, obviously, has kind of a Windows 3.1 or VB-ish look, you know, some sort of strange coloring there. Doesn't even really look like those controls are interactive, but it's hard to say. This one's a little more, you know, some styling went into this, but it's probably just some control vendor's suite with a default styling that they put in there to give some rounded corners and some different colors and stuff to make it look a little less blocky. Let me switch over here to, you know, a more typical one that I didn't get in the slide deck there, but this is one from a customer. I had to omit the name at the top to protect the guilty. But this is more, you know, typical of a line of business one, is just tons of input fields and lots of drop downs and hierarchical this and tree views over here, and everything changes everything and side panels and so on. You know, that's your more typical line of business app. So, you know, trying to meld that into this new world, you have to first understand what some of the upfront design principles are. And the first one up there is this new scenarios. To me, as a consultant who does lots of enterprise line of business type consulting, I think this is the most important one, especially in the near term, as far as, you know, actually building Windows Store applications. If you go and take an app like the one I just showed and say, now let's port that to a Windows Store app, you're probably kind of out of your mind at this point. You're not going to take one of these apps that has 5,000 functions and 400 screens and, you know, 100 different places that dialogues pop up and so on, and try to port that to a Windows Store application if you're sensible, because you really need to go through some significant redesign of the way you present that information. But slicing out new scenarios that your app currently doesn't do, or targeting new audience or new scenarios such as mobile, you know, tablet, touch, form factors, getting people who are out in the field more functional with a tablet-type form factor, The app I just showed you was from a customer that does scientific analysis. Chromatography is the domain. And you know, they had some very good scenarios that this app does currently, but could be extracted from that. Specifically, this app connects to a bunch of devices that do things like heat up samples and extract samples out of containers and then put them through different detectors and all this kind of stuff in the chemical analysis process. In doing that, there's some command and control involved. And it often, for the end users, involves scientists in laboratories or technicians in laboratories. And so for those command and control type scenarios, it would make perfect sense to extract a set of use cases and design a new app around those use cases that is friendly to, you know, a lab technician walking around holding a tablet instead of having to walk up to a workstation, log in, and do those same functions. Or certainly in other, you know, financial business scenarios, there are those people who are decision makers that giving them something where they can have, you know, not have to be at their desk at a computer, a normal desktop computer, to see the data and, you know, maybe buried in 400 other sets of functionality that end user doesn't even use. You give them a specific app for their individual job role and the kinds of things that they do. So I think that's one of the most important here in terms of, you know, where Windows Store apps really start to make sense in line of business, is to attack new scenarios that weren't really there before because we didn't have the form factors and we didn't have the touch input. Fast and fluid, getting things done faster. You know, this is more of a something you get used to, or it could be, you know, something you disagree with. But how many of you have had a Surface for, you know, longer than ordering this week or picking one up? Not many, okay. So I know we're slow to release in Europe. The more I use that, I caught myself 5 times today because I was using my Surface for a while in the speaker room, and then I switched back over to my laptop, and I stabbed that screen at least 20 times in a 10-minute period because it just becomes a more natural interaction for certain kinds of things you do on the screen. So the fast and fluid, getting things done faster, you know, certainly if it's heads down data entry for 8 hours a day, you're not going to get that done any faster on a touch-based device. But if you're doing more kind of an analysis of data, moving through and navigating and things like that, the touch-based gestures help you out a lot there. Now, one of the misconceptions here that, you know, I want to make sure is very, very clear is you'll hear people say that Windows Store apps only make sense if it's a touch device. And that I totally disagree with. You know, you can certainly leverage things better and you can sort of enjoy the experience or be more productive if touch is there, and you should certainly design as if touch will be there. But it doesn't mean that, you know, if some of your users will spend almost all of their time or all of their time with mouse and keyboard because they don't even have a touch-based device yet, you know, that's not a barrier to moving to a Windows Store app. Continue to use internal software. You know, some of this is just marketing Microsoft stuff, let's say, but it's, you know, the fact that those old apps, those old ugly apps, you don't have to port right away. You can keep them running on the desktop and pull these, you know, new scenarios or redesign scenarios out and factor those in as new apps. Same skills. How many people in here are XAML developers? How many are HTML or JavaScript developers? Okay, so, you know, all those hands, you get to use those skills, one of those choices of the way you go about building the app. Certainly there's lots of new learning to go on because now you're programming against APIs that didn't exist before, APIs that are changing out from under us as of yesterday. If you paid attention to some of the build stuff and if you follow some of the links of what they announced yesterday at the build conference in the US, there's lots of changes in 8.1 to the WinRT APIs, some of them even breaking to things we're doing today. There's a talk tomorrow by Tony Champion on background APIs, and I sent him a link that I found in browsing through there, and he's got to add like 5 or 6 new slides to his deck just based on changes to the background APIs in Windows 8.1. So certainly there's a learning curve there, but at least the way you go about developing your app, you can pick the XAML route, you can pick the HTML route, and either way you're using languages, tools, and coding patterns that you're used to, even if you're using new control sets and APIs. The one distinguishing characteristic, and this becomes one of those things that it is a little hard at times trying to convince a company, why should I build, if I'm building a brand new app, why should I build it as a Windows Store app? If you take the touch part out of the equation, so if they say, I'm going to build an app, I'm going to deploy it to desktop machines I already have, they're not touch enabled, there are no mobile scenarios that I am trying to tackle, you know, no tablets are in the equation, what is the advantage to me of building this as a Windows Store app? And there's not much, to be honest, at a technical level, at a coding level, at a platform level, that really jumps out if you take all that other stuff off the table. With one exception, and that is the security model. You know, this is, to a certain degree, it's a whole new operating system from the ground up, at least what gets exposed to our applications. You certainly still have the desktop environment and all the backward compatibility with Windows 7 apps, but for the apps that are built on WinRT, you know, that's from the lowest levels of the operating system up, and we have this nice isolation of applications. So all those scenarios that used to be attack vectors and things that could compromise our systems are no longer there for apps that are built this way. Now, it's, you know, at the current time, as long as that desktop is there and things can be deployed there, it's kind of, to me at least, it's the same argument that if you ever heard the arguments for code access security in .NET, you know, part of the argument for code access security was, well, look, you can build your app as .NET apps, and code access security can protect that app from doing anything on the machine. So therefore, there will be no more viruses. It's like, yeah, so some script kiddie hacker is going to choose to write their app as a managed app when they can just write it as unmanaged and get around all that. So, you know, that threat's still going to exist as long as the desktop option is there. But at least in terms of, you know, it's not really the overt attack that you're trying to protect against here. It's the inadvertent errors and side effects that can be caused by apps that are allowed to do things to other apps. But this is also something that factors into the design and the way you go about building things. Let me just switch over to the desktop here real quick and go to my start screen. Is notice all these yellow squares over here? These are a bunch of SAP applications that are available out in the store if you want to go play with them. They each have a demo mode to them. But the idea is, you know, in the past with desktop applications, we would typically put everything under one big app bubble. If you look at Outlook, Outlook does email, it does calendar, it does tasks, has multiple, you know, kind of disjoint functionality. There are points of overlap between them, but it's not like they have to be side by side in the same application. When you get into this new world, part of that app isolation is that you should, you know, kind of think of things in terms of isolated either task-oriented things for a given user or a given persona. A given user doing their job shouldn't have to jump from app to app to app. If you've broken things up that way, you've done it wrong. But a single user, you know, doing a specific job function for that user should be able to go to one particular app and focus on one thing. If they switch to a different role in their job, going to a different app for that is acceptable and sort of expected in the design of Windows Store apps. So that's why they have, in this SAP example, they've got a family of applications, and they do have points of sharing. These actually don't do sharing between them. We'll talk a little bit more about sharing later. But the idea is you can still have those points of interaction between them by using the sharing contract, but you can have this more isolation of this is what this thing does, it's focused on one thing, does that well, and you go to a different app to get other things done. So the isolate app container is both a technical, you know, enhancement to the way we build things, and it also factors into the way you think about designing these applications. So some of the guidelines there at a top level, what you want to go search for is there's a PDF that sums all this up in about a 300-page document. It's called the Windows 8 User Experience Guidelines. You can just search on that, and you'll find a PDF for it. But, you know, you hear this content over Chrome is part of the buzzword, fast and fluid. You got to throw out those buzzwords. But the overall idea, again, is sparsity is good. The user doesn't have to be overwhelmed with 500 controls on the screen at once. They probably can't interact with 500 controls at once. Give them a smaller cluster of information. Let that information spread out so it's easier to see, consume, and focus on, and then move them to a different page or a different place in the application when it's time for them to focus on something else. So navigation becomes a much more important and top-level construct in your apps, that you move the user from page to page as they focus on one thing or another. Likewise, in terms of getting the Chrome out of the way, we have these app bars that pop out at the top and bottom, and we'll get into examples of those and talk about where you should put things within those app bars. But that's the way you can still have the Chrome but not have it in the user's face all the time. Scrolling, we do things a little different with scrolling in Windows Store apps. It was pretty unusual in a normal desktop line of business app to ever scroll horizontally in the past, but that's a primary mode of interaction, as you'll see in some of my samples. for top-level navigation. When you want to show different aspects of some data, it actually becomes sort of an alternative to putting tabs in place. You can just think of it as taking all your tabs and stacking them side by side and horizontally scrolling between them to get to that data. Semantic zoom is another one that lets you kind of zoom in, zoom out on the context of what you're working on. We'll look at that. Actions, putting buttons in the actual app itself on the surface of the app as opposed to in the app bars, and then those things that should go in app bars. And then at the end, we'll talk some about tiles as well. So this is really more of a summary slide of some of the stuff we're going to cover. So top app bar, there is a division of responsibility here. You have a top app bar and a bottom app bar that can pop out. You can control when they pop out programmatically. So if you want to pop out an app bar because someone selected something on the screen, that's very easy to do. Or you can leave it up to the user to say, I want to do something and I expect it to be in these app bars. Now, you know, one of the things that's a little bit of a leap of faith, if you will, a little bit of a leap of faith is the discoverability of some of this stuff. It's one of those arguments that comes up often as people are first looking at Windows 8 and some of the UI design paradigms is that how's the user going to know to do this swipe or to do the keystroke to get those app bars to show up? And if the fact is that you have dumb users and you are convinced that they're unable to, they will have no other experience of Windows 8 applications over time to learn that that's a common gesture or a common interaction, then maybe you make those app bars always show up, and that's certainly an option. Kind of goes a little bit against the design guidelines, but you could do that if you wanted to. But the idea is that the top app bar here has a dedicated purpose, or it should have a primary purpose, which is navigation. So the idea is that you'll show thumbnails, big fat square tiles, basically, that get you to a different major place within the application. Semantic zoom is really another form of navigation. It's there to facilitate navigation, to let you go from, like I said, if you're designing things well, the user has a small amount of information in their face on the screen at one time, but it may be part of a bigger context of information. So semantic zoom lets them back away, if you will, from that thing that they were focusing on, see the bigger picture, and then go, I want to go over here. Click on that, and then they're zoomed back in to that. And I'll demonstrate this shortly as well, just to emphasize the point. So it also gives you a chance to sort of modify the way you're presenting that data. You go from a detailed, granular view of what they're looking at to a more high-level view where you can kind of alter the labels, alter the rendering, and give them that big picture. You know, it's just like being in an airplane. Pilots always have the, push on the stick, the houses get bigger, pull on the stick, the houses get smaller. It's the same idea with semantic zoom, that you're making things smaller or bigger in terms of the overall context of what they're looking at. All right, so let's look at a few examples of this. All right, so let's start out with app bars. One of the best sample apps here is the weather app that's built in terms of overall navigation schemes and showing some of these things. So first off, the horizontal scrolling I talked about, I'm sure you've all played with this some, but you see that there's separate kinds of context of the data of the overall picture of the weather. And so you can just horizontally scroll between those. If you put your mind back in the context of line of business apps, how might you have presented the same stuff? You might have thrown it all in a tab control and had your summary stuff in one tab and then your detailed in another tab and your maps in another tab and so on. So one way to do that in the Windows Store arena is just expand it out. Part of the reason for this design is the presumption that they might be using touch. Now, if they don't have touch, this just becomes a new form of scrolling they have to deal with, and that may be a negative. If most of your users are not going to be on a touch device, you might not want this, in my opinion. But when you are on a touch device, doing this, flipping the pages of the book is a very natural gesture. So it becomes very easy on touch-based devices to move around within this data and focus on what you want to. In terms of the app bars, I right-click or Window key Z is the keystroke for this, or on a touch-based device, a little swiping gesture from the top or bottom of the screen makes these things pop out. And we're just focusing on the top app bar for now, but you can see that what you get up there are prominent links to major locations, if you will, major pieces of information within the application. They can be hierarchical themselves, so you can see this one shows that maps and places have sort of submenus that you can pop out in a separate flyout and pick from those, so you're not limited to just what you can show, in those tiles. And we'll get to snapping and filled views later, but one thing you always have to take in consideration with these app bars is what are you going to do with them if you're in a snap view and you only have 320 pixels to work with and width. So that's the app bar part of it. Just kind of sequence some stuff here. So app bar, semantic zoom, right. So let me go to one app here. There's a build app here that you'll be able to use even though you obviously aren't attending the build conference. All the content is available online. They're publishing it within 24 hours of the sessions. And you can see the past 2 years of build are also out there. So this one you can. This one actually is a little different in that it starts in what would be considered a semantic zoom kind of view. And when you click on one of these time slots, then it zooms in and it becomes a scrolling view. Most of the other examples out there of semantic zoom usually start you in the zoomed in view, and then you have to zoom out to get to the other stuff. If you're on a mouse and keyboard, the way you invoke semantic zoom is down in the bottom right corner. This little minus sign will zoom you back out. And then you can see you can adaptively render what you show to the user. You could go to alphabetical groupings. You could go to categorical groupings. Here we go to time slots because it's a time-oriented domain. But that's part of the semantic zoom. Let me find another example of that here. Let's see, I believe, I think Push BI does some. So, no, I take it back, this one doesn't. I'm getting my apps confused. Well, for time's sake, I'm not gonna belabor it, you get the idea. So you can put these into apps, you can zoom out, well, even the start screen, of course, has its own zoom. And when you zoom out, you see these clustered groupings. One little trick here I learned actually watching Robert Green was the Microsoft guy who gave this talk in the US. I never knew this existed. When you're in this semantic zoom, you can grab and drag whole groupings of these start screen tiles. So you can drag them off while you're in the zoomed in thing. So you can start a new group when that band shows up there, start a new grouping, then semantic zoom out and drag the whole grouping to where you want it on your start screen. So that's just a handy little tip and trick. Okay, let me switch back here and sequence back to where we were. So in terms of the other app bar at the bottom, there's some guidelines in terms of what you put there and how you organize things. This slide is a little over dogmatic in the way it makes it sound. If you go look at the Windows 8 design guidelines, mostly it just says, be sensible about it. If you really read through the language of it, it's kind of like, do what makes sense. But it does say, you know, keep things that are sort of logically grouped together from the user's perspective, grouped to either the right or the left. Now, what this is talking about is it says persistent commands on the right. The general idea there is if you have commands that are going to show up everywhere or lots of places within your application, such as a refresh icon to refresh the content, things like add. If there are 10 different screens out of 20 where you can add things, then always put the add command over to the right so the user doesn't have to hunt around in the app bars to figure out where it is for that particular screen. So things that show up on more than one screen, or especially things that are there on every single screen, put those over to the right in the bottom app bar. The left is generally for things that are more context-bound, tied to the current selection or what the user is doing in the screen. So you'll kind of push things over to the left, and you just use alignment commands to do this, or alignment settings in your styles, to group them to the left or group them to the right. If you have lots and lots of these, as line-of-business apps tend to do, you know, lots of us have toolbars with groupings and, you know, 500 different commands in the toolbars or menus nested 10 levels deep. How do you do that with these big fat icons in an app bar? Well, you can also do flyout type stuff there. So you can have a button that when you hover on it, it shows multiple related options. So you could have a save button that when the mouse goes over it, or if you click on it, it doesn't actually do anything by clicking on the button. It flies out a menu with the save, save as new, you know, that kind of thing that you can do as variations on whatever that icon represents. The one at the bottom is one of these that, you know, the pendulum is swinging again. So, you know, I'm sure you all remember the days where Office decided it was a good idea to hide menu items that were not currently usable. and then they got negative feedback about that. And so they swung the pendulum back the other way and went back to what was kind of traditional before that, was just disable things that are not available. Well, partly because of this, you know, design paradigm of less is more and not putting things on screen if you don't have to, the pendulum swinging back the other way and saying, no, it's good to hide things from the user if they can't actually do it right now. So as opposed to a traditional line of business app that has those 500 commands in the toolbar, even though half of them don't even pertain to the current screen, the idea is only show things in the toolbar that are relevant to where the user is in the application. So that's what it means by hiding disabled commands. If you have a command that is relevant to the current screen, but the user doesn't have something selected, for example, I would not hide and show that button. I would just disable it and follow the, you know, the kind of standard paradigm there that it's relevant in this context, but it's not relevant based on your selection, then I would just disable the command as opposed to hiding it. But one example you'll see of this is the big back button in the upper left corner of Windows Store apps. When you're on the home screen, well, actually, let me just show it. Let me just switch screens here. Let's go back to the weather app as an example. I know not very line of businessy, but it shows these concepts well. So if I drill down here and I go to this maps here, and then I right-click and get the app bars up, is another way to get it up, right-click in an open area. And then I go off to world weather, and then I right-click and I go to ski resorts, and then I right-click and I go to home. You can see I'm back on the home screen, but that back button is there in the upper left corner. So it's actually in the XAML, and the default styling of these buttons, if you use the templates in Visual Studio, do this automatically for you. The styling of that is that if it is disabled, so is enabled equals false, it's actually got a style that makes it invisible as well. So in other places, you may not want to do that same thing, like I said, if it's still relevant for the context. But the idea here is the normal home screen, if you've just landed there because you started the app, there's nowhere to go back to. So you shouldn't even be showing that button. It's not relevant for the context. But in this context of showing the home screen, we've gone roundabout through our navigation stack, and we are on the home screen, but we got there through a path that we can go back through. So there it's relevant to go ahead and show this. So that's what the hide disable commands is all about. Other things I was going to show with app bars. Let's show a few more examples here. If we go to the mail app, and when you right click here, you can see these clusters I was talking about that on the right hand side, there are things that, now this one kind of violates some of those stuff that was on the slide, and that's, you know, it emphasizes the fact that they're nothing more than guidelines. You can put things where it makes sense for your users. Your app is never going to get rejected from the App Store because some reviewer decides that your refresh should be on the right instead of the left. So in this case, you can see far left there is sync. Sync is probably relevant anywhere you are within this application, but they chose to put it on the far left there. And things on the right, like mark unread, is really contextually bound to the current thing I have selected, so it goes directly opposite what the slide said as well. So that's part of the reason I wanted to show this app is, you know, this is one of the premier built-in apps from Microsoft. It goes directly against those, you know, specific guidelines themselves, but the more general guidelines just say put things in clusters however it makes sense for what you're doing. If we go into one of the apps I want to show here, I'll go to the desktop. And this is a sample app that comes along with the Prism for Windows runtime guidance I talked about in some of my other talks here. It's from the Microsoft Patterns and Practices group, and it demonstrates MVVM and loose coupling and maintainability. If you didn't make that other talk and you want to check it out online, or I've got a Pluralsight course, or I've got an article series on it. But the thing to show here is that this app, I'll show various things in this as we go through, because it is pretty well designed. We hired a separate, I say we because I worked with the team there, we hired a separate design company that was one of the premier design companies Microsoft goes to, and they really put a lot of thought into all the interaction patterns and making sure they align 100% with these design guidelines. Now, this is not truly a line of business either. This would be more a business-to-consumer scenario, but it applies all these same concepts. So in this app, we've got the top navigation here. On the current screen, there is no bottom app bar because there's no contextually bound stuff that we really need to do. But if we drill down a bit, let's say we go down and buy some forks here. When we're on this screen, You can see there is one command down there, and I'll talk more about this at the end, is secondary tiles, but it gives you the ability to pin a particular item that maybe you wanna, you gotta think about it, you may go back and purchase that thing, so you wanna put it on the start screen so you don't forget about it and you can get directly to it. So it's basically a deep link into your application. So that's one that's relevant to where you are in the current app. You show it in the app bar where it makes sense to you. And then we go further into the app, and we add some stuff to our cart, get over here to the cart, and if I right-click that right now, you can see a dark bar down there, but nothing in it. But then once I go and select an item, now I didn't even have to right-click or swipe or anything. The app bar came up programmatically because it says the only reason you would really select something in this screen is if you want to do something to it. So that's a good point to go ahead and just show those commands to the user right away. You know, if there's lots of forms of select, you may not want to pop it up right away. Wait for the user to invoke it. But in this case, the only real reasonable case where they would select something is where they either want to remove it, or in our case, we also support through a flyout, and this is another, you know, kind of design guideline thing, is think about doing things in flyouts. These are what are called light dismissible, meaning if I've got a touch-based device and I touch anywhere else on the screen, it just dismisses that thing. But if I touch anywhere within that little flyout, then I'm interacting with the controls that are within it, and it'll stay up. With the mouse, I can click there, change my quantities, and then just click anywhere outside of it, and it dismisses it. So those are a couple of examples of app bars there. Let me switch back here. So another thing that is, you know, becomes definitely difficult as a line of business developer, you have probably spent a lot of time with, you know, just full screen or maybe windowed, but reasonably sized windowed use of your application in mind. And you probably often have used just static layout of controls that just relying on the fact that if they make it smaller, a scroll bar is going to show up and they'll get to those things that way. In the Windows 8 arena, you really have to start thinking about multiple form factors. And even more so, if you go watch the build keynote yesterday, it's online already, 2-hour keynote, there's a section there where they show about a dozen different new Windows 8.1 devices that are, you know, everywhere from like 7-inch screens, I think were the smallest ones they were showing, up to a tablet that's about this big. Then I'm not sure how you carry around an 18-inch tablet, but it's a form factor where you can pull it off the stand and carry it around as a huge old tablet. And then they, you know, had giant TV-sized monitors as well that you could use. So you really got to think about that a little more, and you know, certainly you can punt and just say, I'm going to, you know, make it usable. It may not be beautiful and graciously laid out for every possible form factor it'll be on, but as line of business developers, often you do have a little more control over exactly what platforms it's going to end up on as well. The other thing that will make your life a little more complicated is part of the announcements yesterday at Build. When I get to the snap view stuff, which I think is coming up shortly, I'll talk about that. Orientation's another consideration. If your app could end up on a tablet, and that should be sort of a foregone assumption when you're designing for Windows 8, is that, like I said, you should always design and accommodate touch, even if a lot of your users won't have it. Because if you don't design to accommodate touch from the start, it'll never get back in there, and people will kind of ask you, why the heck did you pick this platform in the first place, since it's supposedly all about touch. So, but whether you support landscape or portrait is actually optional. It's a setting within your application manifest that you can choose whether you support those different orientations. You shouldn't dramatically change the user experience when you go from landscape to portrait. So if the mode of interaction in your app is horizontal scrolling, like in the weather app when you're in landscape, it should remain horizontal scrolling when you go to portrait. Okay, but then when you go to snapped and filled view, as they're called, the experience can change. So snapped currently in Windows 8 is a 320 pixel wide slice on the left or right side of the screen. And then the filled application is the one that fills the rest of the screen. This, it's important to realize, one of the announcements yesterday in Windows 8.1, this rigid, there's only two apps maximum in the start screen world, goes away. So they showed yesterday, now you can have as many splits as you want, and you can resize those infinitely, you know, within your screen real estate. That's good news for users. That's bad news for us developers, because it was actually, especially those developers who were early adopters and have been building apps, because the way you read the design guidelines made it sound like now and for all time, I can hard code things to 320 pixels wide or wide, and I'll be covered. But now you actually have to think about the fact that it could be 300, it could be, actually they even changed the default. Now the default snap size is 500 instead of 320. So it's a little bit wider by default if you do just a normal snap, but then you can drag it wherever you want from there. So that does mean you have to do a little bit more work. You know, how do you go about that in a XAML world? You're still probably going to use visual states. That's the way you accommodate this today, is there are built-in visual states that get set, a snapped one, a filled one, and then the default, which is called normal, is the one you'll use for full screen. So you can still use those same designs, but you have to put a little more adaptive code in there to say, okay, you're going to get an event, basically, that will tell you as they're dragging the bar to whatever width they want. And it's more like responsive design in the web world, that you'll have to have the equivalent of media queries, if you've heard of those. Media queries in the web world are things that basically set thresholds of width or height, where you switch to a different style, basically, based on what the current width or height is. So here you would have to, in the Windows 8.1 world, you'll have to do something similar, where you'll handle those events, you'll look at the value of how wide your screen is, and then you'll programmatically decide which visual state to go to in terms of your overall layout. But you can still use visual states, and you can even use your existing visual states. You'll just have to have a little more logic about when you do the switching between them. The other thing, just to mention, I said when you're switching from portrait to landscape, you shouldn't be changing the user experience significantly. You may, you know, lay things out a little bit differently, but the primary modes of interaction should be the same. When you switch to snapped, it is acceptable to change the user experience significantly, and I'll show you a few examples in the demo here. So multiple form factors, think about orientation, your snapped and filled views, lots of different screen sizes to accommodate. The scaling for pixel density is talking here about images and graphics specifically, basically saying, you know, if you've got a really high definition screen you're on, you may want to, you know, not put that 16 by 16 pixel graphic and stretch it out just because it's a big screen. That's going to look pretty crappy. You might want to select a higher resolution picture that still takes up the same relative amount of screen but looks good on that high resolution display. Likewise, fonts, you might change your fonts based on the density of the display. But all these things certainly take more work. It's more visual states you got to define to do these kinds of transitions, detecting those different sizes, deciding what sizes make sense, and what graphics or what fonts make sense. So that really does call in the need for a designer to help you out there usually. Condensing app bar commands is another you got to consider when you go to these portrait or filled views. You know, as soon as you go portrait, your screen's less wide, you have less room for all those commands to fit. And certainly when you go into the filled view or snap view, you know, now you're 320 pixel width today, you got to do something to accommodate that. So what'll happen automatically is you can make it so the commands wrap and basically the app bar gets thicker and you can still see all of them. Or you can trim it down. You may do a contextual thing that says, okay, you know, normally I present 10 things because there's room for them, but now that I'm in snap view, you know, there's probably less functionality that you're going to show in snap view in a lot of cases, so you may trim it down to just the two or three most important. And then another thing you can do there with snap view is you can, you know, have an extra button, maybe a dot, 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 that when they click on that, it unsnaps the application. You can programmatically unsnap an application, so you can give them some kind of hint there that there is more here you can do, you just can't do it in this form factor. All right, so let's look at a couple examples here of different things you might do. Oh, let's see, I'm stabbing the wrong buttons up here. Different things you might do in snapped or filled. While I'm here in this app, let me just show that this app, we put a lot of time, we being the rest of the team, not so much me, a lot of time into making sure every single view within this application is still fully functional even when in snap view. And that means a lot of visual state stuff, a lot, I talked with the developers when this was being finished up, asked them, you know, how much of your time do you think you spent on programmatic logical functionality in this app, and how much of it did you spend on visual styling and layout? And their estimate was over 50% of their time was spent on styling and layout. So it does, you know, kind of raise the point that if you're going to be fully functional in all these different form factors and stuff, it doesn't come for free. But this one shows that, you know, same kind of interaction that the app bar is down there. Now, one thing you'll typically change is in these smaller views, you'll take away the text. If you remember, if I unsnap, I believe these have text on them when you're in the unsnapped. So one, you know, screen real estate reduction thing. If you don't know this gesture, just grab at the top to put something in snapped with a mouse. And we can, you know, fully navigate around in this app. We can go back out to our product details that we were. We can have the top level navigation. Again, the text goes away, but the icons remain. We can go back to our thing. We can check out. We can log into the app. We can start filling out our shipping details and stuff. Notice the difference in layout here. We go from a vertical scrolling when we're in snapped to a horizontal scrolling when we're in full screen mode. And I believe even in filled mode. So let me put this guy here. Let me window tab to another app. And then if I drag this over, yeah, so the filled you generally are going to treat the same as when you're in full screen, but it's the snap view that you specifically accommodate. But you could potentially do specific rendering for both. Now, another one I want to show here that does things a little different is this push BI that is a little more line of business-like. Let me get rid of my snap here. And you can see this is another horizontal scrolling. It's got different kinds of information here. It's got drill down navigation that you can go into a particular thing and see the details of it, reports associated with it, comments, and so on. And I believe there's some, you know, specific things you can do down here in the app bar as well to filter and so on. But this app, once you go into Snap View, what they choose to do is take you to a specific rendering. So they're still functional, they're still useful. They picked out a particular thing where they said, if they're not really just immersed in my application, there's probably, you know, one thing they want to do. They want to kind of passively monitor their favorite activities here and see what the stats are on those while they're over in the filled view doing their real work. Same thing, you know, picture a Twitter feed over here, picture your email inbox. They'll all do a similar thing, put some sort of summary level thing while you're in the snap view, but don't necessarily let them navigate view to view to all the views within your application the way the AdventureWorks shopper did. Now, you can also certainly do this. Let's get rid of the snap here and snap this guy. And you'll see a lot of apps that do this. They basically punt. And they say, I don't know, it's just too much work to figure out what I actually want to put there, so I'll just put some kind of logo. And I'd say the majority of the apps that I've used out of the App Store actually do this. They don't really, there's no functionality in SnapView. This will still pass certification. It'll still get into the App Store. If you do something horribly strange and weird when you go into SnapView, then it won't pass certification. You have to support SnapView and FilledView. But support is a loose term. This is supporting SnapView. It's doing something sensible. Not functional, but sensible. Okay, so those are some of your options there in terms of filled, snapped, and so on. Tiles and toast notifications. This is certainly part of the top-level user experience of using Windows 8 in general, is you've got your live tiles out on the start screen. The idea is, at least the underlying premise of the design, is that these live tiles, the fact that they can have dynamically updating information, can be more rich and engaging for the user while they're on the start screen. You know, I'll put it in the context of the line of business here in a moment. Some people do complain about this and say, you know, it basically makes your screen look like a bunch of unruly kids in a room popping and jumping and not sitting in their seats. So it annoys some people having all that activity on their start screen. But the general idea is that you can still deliver information to the user even when your app is not running and is not the main thing on the screen. And keep in mind, your start screen can even be a snap view itself. So I'll show you here in a moment via demo, you know, you can actually put live tiles that convey useful, meaningful business information and then use that as basically a management portal, if you will, to display information in snap view on the periphery while you're working in the main app in a filled view. Toast notifications are another variation of these. You've probably seen these. They pop down from the top right of the screen, you know, just a new form of the bottom right pop-ups there. And those are designed to pass along additional information to users when they're focused on other things. There are several forms of these we'll talk about in a slide or two. General idea, though, is the user is in control. There are settings for all these things. So if you don't like the unruly kids jumping up and down in their seats, you can go turn that stuff off. You do have to do it on an app-by-app basis, but you can turn those different things off if you don't want them. There are different forms of notifications, and some of these apply to both the pop-up notifications and the tile notifications, and some are specific to the tiles. The key thing here is, you know, in terms of the application lifecycle of your Windows Store apps, it's very important to understand that when your app is not on screen, it is not running. It may be in memory, all your objects, controls, transient input from the user, all that stuff can still be held in memory and can come back as soon as they put the app back on screen. But while it is off screen, it has no threads of execution. So the first one there, local notifications, notice the while your app is running. So this may seem a little weird because it's like, well, if your app is already running, why can't you just show them something on the screen, you know, somewhere within the context of your app? And the general idea is you should. If it's something like they press the save button, don't pop a toast notification going, I saved. You know, for things that are directly within the context of what they're doing, don't use toast notifications. But for things that are maybe a little background-ish, you know, they click a sync button and it's going to take a while, maybe you do a toast notification to say sync is done. There was another good example I was going to try to say and I forgot it, but you get the idea that if the context of what you're going to put as a notification is sort of out of the user's focus and it's something that takes a little longer or happens when they're not, you know, making that thing happen themselves, then doing it as a local toast notification can make sense. There's also local tile notifications, which basically means your app can make your live tile update its content, but what's kind of weird about this is it only happens while your app is running. So the user won't see that effect until they go back to the start screen, but your only opportunity to make the content change if you're using local notifications is while the app is running. So you can either do it as the app starts up, or there's also a suspended event that as your app is going off screen will fire, so that's an opportunity to do a last minute update to the live tile to maybe show the last couple emails they were looking at, the last stats of whatever they were working on in the application. Scheduled is just a slight variant on that. It also has the while your app is running caveat there, but it can be on a timer-based interval. So maybe you know you have a scheduled thing that goes and makes a call to a service and checks for new items and gives them a pop-up that says there's new things in your work queue that you need to address. And so now they know to navigate to the work queue screen of your application and go see what's going on there. Periodic is similar to scheduled, but this one does apply only to tiles. And it is basically a way you can schedule when the operating system, your app does not have to be running for this one, and it basically will go out and pull a service and pull down new content for your tile. So it's just a way, and this is what most apps end up doing for their live tile, is on a polling basis, they'll go out and pull down some new content. So that's why, you know, on the start screen with the people app here, you see the, you know, different faces and mugshots up there rotating eventually, maybe, sort of. Got Bill Zach's face up there forever. But those things are just pulling and, you know, getting a new notification. These are basically just a chunk of XML that comes down from the server that says what is the structure. You can say what your structure is there and the content expressed through the XML that comes down through that service call. The push notifications are a way to update that, you know, even if the app doesn't do it and if the app doesn't schedule it. You can actually basically poke a service on the back end. So you have to set something up on some back end service that is running. Could be a Windows service on some server box of yours, or it could be a web service or something that you poke from some other application or some other machine. It goes out through the cloud basically to the Windows push notification service, and then the push notification service, if you've registered for that, will actually, you know, push something to the operating system that can cause the tile to update. So even if you don't do the periodic, you can still have these dynamically changing things in your live tiles. So let me just show one or a couple of things to do with this that we haven't already talked about. If you look at this Push BI application, for example, it's just got a static live tile, not live tile, if you will. It's just got a static tile there. But one thing they support here that kind of gets into this dashboardy type stuff I was talking about before is they support the concept of secondary tiles. So these are deep links into some particular view in your application. And I showed before that on any of these, we can drill down. So there may be, you know, key performance indicators here that a particular manager is responsible for, and they want to keep an eye on those things, especially anytime their desktop is up on the screen. So let's pick a few of these here. Let's say we want instant response time. And when we're down in that view, we can right click and you see this pin icon. And I showed this before in the context of the Adventure Work Shopper to pin a particular product. We support that in that app as well. So we go ahead and say pin to start here. You can change what the title is that's going to show up on the start screen. And that title actually doesn't overlay the tile. It's more the tooltip that shows up when you hover on it. So we can pin that one. We could go back out here. Pick something else, maybe, let's see, something red, customer service. So we'll pin that one, and maybe one more that's good news, such as sales revenue. So we'll go ahead and pin that one. And then we go out to our start screen. They always show up at the far right, but what you can do is, the little trick I showed you before, is we can go ahead and create a new cluster for these. And then we can do that semantic zoom trick and say, okay, you know, we want this right in our face every time we're on the start screen. And that also means that if we were to shrink the start screen down and make it the snapped view, you know, it's right there in our periphery anytime we want. And so you can put, you know, relevant business information that dynamically updates either periodically or through push notifications out there in your live tiles. And these will actually switch colors if, you know, this data is not actually changing in that way. But if you went from red to green, you can put that in that XML payload that comes down from the service calls to say, okay, now the background color is this, the icon is this, this is the text that goes in there, this is the layout, the structure that I want for that data. You do have some limitations on the layout. There's some fixed layout arrangements there, but you can put, you know, kind of left, right, top, bottom type information there. So those secondary tiles can be, you know, very useful in turning the start screen into a business context that you can use. Okay, sharing. How many people have used the share charm or the sharing contract? Anyone? A couple of hands? Okay. So this gets back to what I was talking about before when I showed all those yellow tiles of the SAP application and said you might want to consider starting to break things up. Like, you know, there is no Outlook for Windows RT, although there probably will be because of overwhelming demand for it. There is a mail app, and there is a calendar app, and there is, you know, a tasks app, or at least third-party ones out there at this point. And you can still do things like create an appointment from an email, but you do it through the share charm. So just to demonstrate how this works and point out some limitations to be aware of in a business context, let's just go out to something like the news app. It supports the sharing contract. And we'll scroll over here and try to find something happy or relevant. There was at least some sort of Microsoft announcement on here earlier, but it's already gone out of scope. So we'll say Samsung rolls out a prediction here. So the way the share charm works at a user experience level is that they can not right click, go in, this is one of those operating system app bars, if you will. They go out here to the bottom right or swipe from the right side of the screen on a touch device and go to the share charm. Get it up there again. And you can see what it's going to do is list all of the apps that have registered to be able to share a particular content type. So what they actually use is these MIME types effectively. They're not specifically MIME types, but similar to that concept on the web, that you register your app and you say you're capable of sharing a particular content type. So it could be as simple as I can share any string out there, and then you're expecting to somehow parse that. That's kind of the brain dead way of doing sharing, but then you're often going to, you know, accept some content you have no way to deal with. There are some, you know, very well-defined things such as email, tweets, things like that, or top-level constructs that they have built-in types for. There's also actually a specification out on the web for things like products or inventory or, you know, major business concepts that they have some common set of fields that you might want to define as part of that kind of thing, and there are types associated with that you can use with the share contract. The limitation I want to point out here is once you get to this point, your program can pop this out programmatically if you want. So if you want them to click something within your application that says, you know, send to calendar, for example, is a prominent button on the screen, you can certainly do that and pop this thing out. But from that point, your app is out of control. Okay, so if the user wants to take your proprietary company information and accidentally click on the tweet button and tweet it, there's no way for your app to control that at the current time. So that's one limitation to be aware of. It's not a reason not to use the share contract, but it does mean at least put some thought into the things you allow your users to share. And the experience from there would be if I went off, said I wanted to mail this, it's going to fire up that application. Your app, when you support the settings or the share contract, you get to define what is the view that you present while you're sharing. So this is actually, my app has been activated. The mail app has been activated at this point. It is on screen. It's got threads. It's got memory. And it presents a particular view. And we can go ahead and select someone in here. I'll just put in my own email address here. So I'll send something to myself and send it on its way. And as soon as the email is sent there, it just goes away. So your app also, the apps, when they support the sharing contract, also have control of when they dismiss themselves, you know, when the interaction is complete, to complete that interface of sharing. You could write it off to disk in your local storage for the next time the app starts up. You know, maybe you're just sharing some data that you want to add to a document, and then you're going to go formulate that document later. Things like that to share between different applications, some sales data that you want to push over to an app that you're then going to, you know, incorporate into a report and send to someone. You can do all those kinds of things, but you'll have to figure out what data you want to share, and then you'll design the user interface for what is the sharing experience within that destination application. Then, finally, there's data, which is obviously kind of important to business applications. And this is definitely the arena that gets the least attention when you go look at all the samples and even a lot of the samples I've been showing you so far. The problem is they just don't put it into the context of business apps. They don't have those 500 inputs on the screen and tabs of this and tabs inside of tabs and data grids inside of tabs and double click on a row in the data grid and it swaps to a different view that has more tabs and so on. You know, you just don't see samples like that because, first off, you shouldn't design things that way anymore. You know, every one of those things is a context switch for the user. There's a different way to do that. You can put those context switch into a whole page navigation, or you can do it by modifying the view that they're within in different ways other than those traditional ways. And I'll show a few of these as we go here. So, things you can do, you know, first off, I said it already, but let me reemphasize, even if you expect most of your users initially will be a keyboard and mouse, you should be designing so that if they have touch, they can use it. You know, it's not going to be long before it's common to ship most laptops and most desktops with touch-enabled monitors. And as soon as they get that touch-enabled monitor and they start trying to use your app and it doesn't behave normally now that they have touch, you're going to be the one they call. And it's a lot harder to put it in later and move things around later than designing for it up front. In terms of presenting data, you know, the biggest thing missing, and this is not unique to Windows 8, is there is no data grid control for us to use. If you, you know, look at WPF, when it first shipped, there was no data grid there either. They at least had a list view that was for tabular presentation. It had a built-in grid view. We do have a list view here in Windows Store applications, but it's more of a fancy list box by default. But it is a templatable control. So I'll show you some examples where you can just use a straight list box and stylize it and turn it into a tabular presentation of data. Or you can go out to the third-party market, and I'll show you a few examples of that as well. The third-party control vendors, Telerik, Component One, I don't think Infragistics has one yet, but DevExpress does. I'll show a couple of those. They do have, you know, sort of first-class data grids. Now, they may not be as fully functional as get these little tickles. They may not be as fully functional and, you know, rich data interactive, entering all your data through a data grid kind of thing. But that's something a lot of people have been trying to convince people to stop doing for a long time anyway. You know, when it comes to heads down data entry, a grid is not really a good place to do it in a lot of cases. It can be, you know, rapid tab, tab, tab kind of entry if that's really what you need, but you can tab, tab, tab between fields pretty well as just as quickly. So the general idea is here, even with the third-party grids, most of them do support some degree of data entry in the grid. But if it's heads-down data entry, the idea is select something and take them to a details view, more of a form entry kind of presentation of that data. And then it's just labels and text boxes generally. There's also the grid view, and this is one that, you know, certainly has been kind of overused in samples and design guidelines and stuff. They make you think that the entire world of Windows 8 applications always starts with the grid view, and every time you present more than one item, it's in a grid view in big fat square tiles. And you know, a lot of the apps I showed you today are following that model. Certain data is just not consumable in a grid view. I'll give you an example that I can't show because it stopped working on me for some reason, but there's an app. I'll leave the app name out of it, not to bash them. But let's just say there is an app in the Windows Store that is capable of consuming something called Instapaper. If you don't know what that is, it's a service that has a web presence. It has apps on other devices. It lets you quickly, when you're on a web page, a blog post, something like that, click a button, and it just kind of puts it into a reading list for you. And it can download those in the apps and view them offline. There's an app that consumes the Instapaper web service and makes it consumable as a Windows Store app. But instead of putting things in a little bit wider view, they put everything in big, fat, square tiles. How easy is it to really visualize that this is an article with some content when it's jammed into a square title or a square tile? Not very well, because usually the title doesn't even fit, so it gets cut off. And then they show some text for the article, and that all gets cut off too. So that's a good example of bad use of grid view. And certainly a lot of business data fits in that same arena. There may be a few top-level pieces of information that, if you picture a typical data grid that maybe had 10, 15 columns in it, you know, if you do enough thought about it and you have a narrow enough user set, you might be able to say, really, these four columns I can put as stacked pieces of information in a square tile, and maybe that'll work out for you. But even that's not really natural to a lot of our users, right? They've been dealing with data grids their whole life in their job. There's no reason to yank it out from under them if that's the way they think about the data. And especially, there's often visual correlation tasks, right? You know, you can't always design every possible way the users are going to compare data into some sort of comparison interface. Sometimes they just want to throw it in a grid, sort it or filter it in a particular way, and let their eyes and their brain do the correlation between different entries in that data grid. Those big fat square tiles do not work well for that kind of correlation task. So putting things in the data grid, you know, for the current time, just like in WPF when it first came out, you pretty much got to step out to the third-party market. Hopefully Microsoft will hear the pressure and get us a first-class data grid in one of these releases of Windows 8. 8.1 does not have one yet. But you'll see that you can get pretty far even just with the list view and some data templates. Avoid showing too much data. That just goes back to the general design paradigm of Windows 8, that less is more. You know, open white space in your screens is less stress on the users, according to psychologists and people who have studied this, and let people kind of navigate between different contexts as their focus shifts. So let me just go back to demo mode and show a few examples of this. All right, so not news. Let's go back to Push BI, and let me just talk about a few more things in this one. You know, first off, like I showed, they have this scrolling view. You can certainly have live feeds of data that shows these, you know, scrolling key performance indicators over on the left. You have these different categories of data that are being shown as square tile-y type information because they're conducive to it. So this is where I said, you know, a traditional line of business app probably would have had this data in a table and just would have had columns for the title and the numbers and stuff, and maybe a little snap line there for the graph. You spread it out to a tile and you can show a little bit more information about that. When you drill down to particular things, you can show graphs and things like that. Perhaps a slightly better one is this SAP fact-finding sheet. Let me go back to the home screen on this one. Oh, it doesn't give a home navigation. So we'll have to back our way out. Okay, so this is the home screen on this one. You can see that another alternative to tabs, before I was showing just stack things out horizontally and treat that as your new tab metaphor. Another way to do tabs is just have these prominent titles that you can click on up at the top that act as, you know, filter criteria on the data, if you will. But you could use those as, you know, show me my inbox, show me my calendar, show me my tasks, if you wanted to put all those into a single application. You could just have those as clickable links that function pretty much like a tab view did, just without the Chrome around the changing views. In this case, it's acting as filter criteria on the underlying data. And if you have a lot of those, you can certainly use flyouts and drop-down lists to select different kinds of filters there. So we could pick one of these. Let's go back up here, and I'll pick this one because it has a cool-looking building. And then you have different kinds of data that you're going to show. So this is one of those, again, that goes into the horizontal scrolling metaphor that you could certainly picture if you were looking at data about a particular customer. You might have a tab for key facts, a tab for charts, a tab for notes, a tab for invoices. But you just stack it out horizontally here and group things in logical ways, and it's still a very nice presentation of the data, and it's very touch-friendly. You know, I didn't emphasize it before about the touch, but the key thing to always be thinking about there is don't put things too close together, because then the user can't get that precise with their fingers when they're using it in a touch mode. So that's the reason for all the extra white space in here. And if I go back to the AdventureWorks Shopper application, it's probably out here still running somewhere. Yeah. Notice how far apart these data inputs are. That's designed around the idea that they may be touching their way through these, filling them out, you know, without a tab key at their disposal, and you want to make it very easy to get your finger on the right control. Even if you're in snap view, you can see they're nice and spread out there. All right, let's come out of snap view. What else to show here? When you drill down on some of these items, you know, a master detail kind of presentation, left and right, top and bottom, however you want to do it, is still certainly available. And here you can see things. This is just a one variant of a stylized list view that lets you present that information in a, you know, simple two-column kind of table. If you go out to the weather app again, we saw earlier, but I didn't highlight, you know, the hourly forecast is just a scrollable list, but it's broken up into logical columns that the user sees as basically a nice stylized data grid. It does not support selection in this case because there's nothing to do with those items, but if they were things that maybe you have subsequent navigation or the ability to go to an edit screen for one, then you would support selection there and probably have an app bar that pops up to let you do the subsequent actions. Let's see here. Other example, oh yeah, the third-party controls, I wanted to show a couple examples of that. I'm going to, like I said, Infragistics does not have a data grid at this point. DevExpress and Telerik are two that do. So let me just show Telerik since it's at the top of my screen there. Oh, that's the control panel, sorry. Let's go back. Oh, I got it grouped over here to the left. That's why I'm looking the wrong place. It is right here. Okay, so they have a data grid, and this is just their sample app, but you can step through some of these and see that this does start to look more like a traditional data grid. But notice that we don't have Chrome around it, and we don't have five other panels surrounding it that the user can't focus on all at one time. We just have the thing they're dealing with, the data grid. And this one supports, you can see at the top here, they've got filtering, they've got sorting on columns that make sense to sort. You can show different things, collapse and hide things in theirs. They've got a various other, I think they have a hierarchical example in here, so you can use grouping as a hierarchical way to present data. So lots of capability there, similar to any, you know, current data grid you'd expect in smart client technologies. Likewise, if we look at the DevExpress ones, they have a couple of like full sample apps that come along with theirs that show it more in a business context. So this one's a, you know, pseudo CRM type of application. We've got the starting landing page or hub page. You've got these kind of major areas that you can horizontally scroll through. Some of these you can drill down, so we can click an item here. We go down and we've got a data grid of specific activities that we can go through and select items and have specific actions relative to those items. We page navigate back up to where we were. We can drill down to some other thing that decides to present things as tiles at this point because there's a nice you know, way to render those, especially if they have imagery associated with them. Square tiles get really boring if you don't have imagery associated with them. So just raw data and stuff generally doesn't look that good in square tiles. But if there's kind of graphical information, whether it's a little chart, you know, a spark line or something, or actual imagery, that presents well in these square tiles. This one actually has, I'm not sure if all of these navigate, so this one navigates and it also shows off some of their other controls that they have some dials and gauges and things like that that show up in this application, and just different styles of their data grid as well. This one's actually a little less functional out of the box. It doesn't have the built-in filtering. I'm not sure if it supports hierarchy off the top of my head. It's mainly just sorting and tabular presentation. But you can see some of these areas, since it's a sample app, aren't clickable. They have some tiles over here that are just meant to represent things you could do. Then they've got this one that, you know, you can still put other information on the screen, like these bars and, you know, detail information, master detail type stuff on the right, but just don't get carried away and put a whole bunch of different contexts on the screen at one time in a modern UI app. All right, so that is about it. Let me switch back here. That was my data demo. I don't really have an overall summary slide. Let me get to the QR code there. So, you know, in summary, start thinking about your own apps, your own use cases, your own users specifically, and the way they use your apps, and try to identify things that make good candidates for moving into this world. Discourage your boss if they are saying, take our 400 screen line of business app and port it to Windows Store application, at least in my opinion. Microsoft employee might say different, but in my opinion, don't do that. Figure out good use cases that will live nicely in this new design world, especially if there is an opportunity to put it on a mobile form factor and have it touch enabled and have that enable new scenarios for your business. And those are the good candidates to jump into this world with. With that, I will take questions. Please do fill out your evals. Been getting a really low number of evals all over in the conference. Those are important to myself and the conference. So please do fill out an eval. I'll take a few minutes for that. I'll stick around if there's questions. Otherwise, I will be down in the Ask the Experts shortly, and we can talk more over beers. So enjoy the rest of the conference. Have a good evening. Why don't you just come up for the question?